alternatives thought that, and they were dead wrong. They were dead wrong. So Frank makes the point in this book that yeah, you're gonna elect Clinton. Actually, I'm not sure he, you know, connects the dots here, but maybe he does this. I don't quite remember. I did read the book a couple times, but you connect the dots in many Democratic Party administrations and the presidential level. And the people that should be fighting the same policies that they do, that a Republican would do, like a lot of what Reagan did, filed from Carter. A lot of what Bush did, filed from Clinton. Under Bush, there'd be a protest. Under Clinton, no. Under Reagan, protest. Under Carter, no. You know, so the Democratic Party is often, not always, but often just a thing to hide behind to make the same policies happen that hurt workers and youth, you know? And anyway, you were going to say something. Sorry. Wait.
No, they also, it's like hiding behind the cloaks of reality. Yeah. And basically they pride themselves of being, oh, the party of the people and things get done, blah, blah, blah. And in reality, it's just a cloak for the same policies a right-winger would do.
Yeah, and that was one of Frank's points, was that whatever happened to the party of the people, I think is maybe the subheading of the book. Yeah, there it is. Whatever happened to the party of the people. And the problem is that he doesn't go deep enough to discover that it never was the party of the people. It was the party of the slave master. I mean, I was thinking about FDR this morning, right? So FDR, think about the 1930s, right? We have New Deal, right? And we think the New Deal was really great, right? Now, if you really research it, you find out that the New Deal had times where, yes, there was money put forward for social programs, but it was also yanked back. The 30s was a long decade. Roosevelt doesn't get elected till 32. He comes in as a Hoover conservative. The situation is so horrible that he ends up, taking this leftward, if you want to look, use those terms, a left-leaning policies that, to his own admission, were to save capitalism. And he used to say that to the right-wingers that hated him. He'd say, "Why do you dislike me? I'm saving capitalism for you." He'd say that openly. But think about the South during the 30s. Jim Crow is in full force. Did the Roosevelt administration do anything to stop Jim Crow? I'm not aware of that, if they did. Did they do anything to stop the segregation of the army and so on before World War II started, or even in the beginning of World War II?
Even during.
Yeah, even during. Did they? Who put the Japanese people on the West Coast in internment in concentration camps? Roosevelt administration. You know, you could go on and on. The more deeply you look into it, facts are nasty things, folks, especially liberals that don't want to think. They just want to do the same gut reaction that a lot of conservatives do. The facts are nasty things. But, you know, you had deep, deep poverty in the 30s that was never solved, never even touched on. You had Roosevelt doing a lot of anti-union stuff, calling out troops on strikers more than any other president in history. You had the racism, the endemic racism, didn't touch that. You know, after the war, the GI Bill and all that, there were a lot of restrictions against people of color, black Americans especially, from taking advantage of a lot of that stuff. The mortgage, lower cost mortgages, the GI Bill to go to college and all that, it was all rigged in a racist way.
And this is how they got off with the New Deal and all the programs that are attached to it was excluding all people of servitude. Like, let's say you're a maid, and who were the maids back then?
Right.
By the majority, or a cook or whatever, African Americans. Yeah. So they were excluded. Yeah. They didn't say that. They did it in a way that we're not saying black. We're just saying we're excluding these workers, and the majority, knowing that the majority of those workers are African American.
Exactly. And anyway, we're gonna get a quick legal ID here. We are WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community Based Radio at 91.5 FM. And also known as Tufts Educational Radio. Lots of names for the same wonderful radio station. And I noticed the students are starting to come back here in Boston. We're in the greater Boston area. We're in the literally on the border of Medford and Somerville, two cities that are on the border of Boston. And here at Tufts, I believe the students are coming back this week, at least maybe some freshmen I think I've seen walking around. And also at other schools, the students are coming back. And welcome back. There's going to be a lot of socialist alternative activity to try to organize students more. We have, like, for example, the branch I'm in Worcester is mostly students at Clark University and Worcester State University. Here in Boston, there are many students from Northeastern and UMass involved with socialist alternative in three different branches. There's one around Cambridge, Somerville. There's one down in Dorchester and one in sort of meets in mid-Boston. And so look out for Socialist Alternative this fall in your area. And if maybe not at your school, if you're willing to travel a little bit. For people listening outside of Boston, I just want to alert people to September 19th. That's a Monday at Clark University. Room to be announced. We're going to have a speaker. Socialist Alternative will be having a meeting on the need for socialism worldwide, actually, including here. And we'll have a speaker from Britain, a Marxist from Britain, will be coming to speak. And also we'll have a meeting at Worcester State University that same day. And in Boston, I believe the meeting will be on there'll be two meetings on the 20th, one at Northeastern and one at UMass Boston. So go to socialistalternative.org for more information on that, on those meetings. And also when we get more information, we'll put it up on the Facebook page of Socialist Alternative Radio. And we want to thank listeners for responding to stuff we put up on the page and for listening to the show. You can listen via coming to or getting to the website here at WMFO, WMFO.org. Go to schedules, click on Social Alternative Radio, get one show at least archived because they only archive two and we're on every other week. But also Feeney and Rising, both a website and a web page, Feniian, Rising, second word, Feeney and Rising, has been keeping up pretty well, it seems like. And thank you very much, Feeney and Rising, for keeping up with downloading our shows and having them there so you can check out a bunch of shows. And we were just talking about a book review that I wrote. My name's Jeff Booth. I wrote this book review in Socialist Alternative's latest issue. And it's not so much that I wrote it, but what it's about. And it is one of the things you can use in battling lesser evilism and voting for corporate politicians like Clinton and Trump in this election and not voting for them, especially. I started the review off with this quote I like. Quote, none of them think she really means her populism. The Clinton Foundation has actually held meetings at the headquarters of Goldman Sachs. This is from William Cohen, who wrote Why Wall Street Loves Hillary in Politico in 2014, and Thomas Frank uses that quote in the book. Frank himself points out, which I focused the review on, just some quick headlines about successive Democratic Party administrations. We were just talking about Roosevelt, which is good because that's one I didn't have room to go after Roosevelt, the FDR, the big hero, big icon. But I think that's one way to attack lesser evilism because they'll invariably come up with some iconic Democratic Party myths, you know, like what about JFK? What about FDR? What about, you know, Roosevelt? I meant another one. What about, who's the other one they really LBJ? Like? Yeah, they talk about LBJ now, which is really hilarious because you couldn't even do that until recently because everyone still remembered that Vietnam War and problematic attitudes towards civil rights and all that and the repression of the Black Panthers and all that. That was a little after LBJ, but still. And yeah, all of a sudden LBJ is being sort of whitewashed and turned into, because of the Great Society period and some of the reforms, you know. But, you know, that gets a little tricky because as I think Frank points out and a lot of people point out now that are trying to dissect the two-party duopoly, they say, look at, if you're saying there's this lesser evil thing that works somehow, why is it that Nixon, a conservative, arch-conservative, fierce anti-communist, why under his administration did all this progressive stuff get passed, like the Environmental Protection Act, Roe versus Wade, you know, abortion rights, First Earth Day, OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration? Turns out all this progressive stuff was passed during Nixon. Is that because of Nixon or because of the Republicans? Absolutely not. There was actually a conservative Supreme Court as well. Was it because of all that stuff? Absolutely not. It was because of the mass movement on the streets against the Vietnam War that triggered other mass movements for women's rights, for environmental protection, etc. And that's why, so that's why the whole Lesser Evil thing just collapses from any angle you look at it. Whether you look at it from within, sort of, is the Democratic Party really passing this legislation, or are they responding to pressure and mass movements, or from even the Republicans, which are supposed to be impossible to get anything passed, and look at what they're doing, and look what they're forced to do, you know? And so, for example, Frank does go into how that basically the whole myth of, well, like Obama couldn't do anything because the Republicans were in control of the Congress, or Clinton could only do so much. Now, let's talk about Obama for a second. Both the first 2 years of Obama's administration, 2008, 2010, something like that, 2009, 2011, around that, 2008, 2010 more, might be more likely, and Clinton's first 2 years, that was Democratic Party-dominated Congresses. Congress was controlled, both House and Senate and presidency, by Democrats. And in those 4 years, they could have passed anything they wanted, and they didn't do anything. They did regressive things. With Clinton, for example, Clinton got so into his new, into pushing the Democratic Party from his perspective to the right and doing things that you would normally think just a Republican would do if you bought into the two lesser of two evils thing. Let's do a quote here again. Frank examines Clinton's days as president, telecommunications deregulation, the racist 1994 crime bill, ending welfare as we know it in 96, NAFTA, ending welfare as we know it, then in 96, NAFTA. So by 96, and this is quoting Frank, Thomas Frank, America had two conservative presidential candidates to choose from. That's in 1996 elections. And this is a part I didn't have time to go into in the book review, but people should really examine this more. And I saw a recent, I was really pleased to see a recent look at this sort of, or acknowledgement of it. And I forget where I was reading it. Frank exposes Clinton's bipartisan plans to privatize Social Security toward the end of his second term. So as Clinton, and this is the famous Monica Lewinsky saved Social Security. Did you ever hear that phrase?
No.
Okay, so Monica Lewinsky, as people may know, is someone Clinton had an affair with, an intern Clinton had an affair with, and he was officially, you know, censured for that, officially impeached, but it didn't really lead to his full impeachment or having to leave office. So, but this took up so much time focusing on defending Clinton by Clinton himself and others, that his big plan with Newt Gingrich, who was a Republican, Clinton and Gingrich had been meeting privately to develop a whole plan to privatize Social Security in increments. They had a whole, like, you know, campaign to say it was bankrupt, which it really wasn't. And then they were going to have a series of some sort of meetings to come out with alternatives. And basically the whole thing was to privatize Social Security, get rid of Social Security. So Clinton could have been known as got rid of it, welfare as we know it and Social Security as we know it. And people are about to vote for Hillary, who supported that stuff. It's not like Hillary, I'm not saying because Hillary was his wife that she's culpable. She's culpable because she agreed with that. She agreed with that stuff. That doesn't mean she's going to try to privatize Social Security right away, but it's an option for her, for their type, meaning the Democratic Party politicians. So the only thing that saved them from following through on this bipartisan, you know, Gingrich, Republicans, Clinton, and the Democrats, privatizing Social Security, is the Monica Lewinsky affair. That's the only thing, really, that's turned their way. That's how some people see it. I think that's a little reductive, but whatever. So anyway, let's move on to some other articles real quick. Actually, first I want to go back to the 15 now. I want to urge people to check out the victory in Minneapolis of both getting $15 minimum wage on the ballot for this fall, for the November election vote, and to look at what it took in terms of getting the number of signatures, which is a ton, 30,000 I believe it was, and getting the court case by miracle so far won to get it on the ballot after the Democrats. And please note, the Democrats are the ones that tried to stop this from happening. There were only two Democrats that wanted to allow this to go through. The rest voted against it going to Democrats in the City Council of Minneapolis. So let me just read a quick quick headline from 15mn.org. Vote for 15mn.org. Another place to get more info. Vote for 15mn.org. France Today, we won in court. This is from August 23rd by Ginger Jetson. Today, we won in court. A judge ordered the city of Minneapolis to let the people vote and put $15 an hour on the ballot November 8th. This is a massive victory for all working people in Minneapolis who dared to challenge big business and the majority of city council members that opposed our movement for 15 from the beginning. Notice the majority of city council members. That's the Democratic Party majority. We can win in November. They dissect a lot of polling info. This is from socialalternative.org if you want to read it in detail. And again, August 23rd, Ginger Jensen, 15 on the ballot in November, something like that. I don't know the exact title. It got cut off. But anyway, I don't want to read all this. Let's see. Good information on the polling data. The polls show, for example, the polls showed a study 83% of African Americans and 74% of women voters supported our proposal for $15 on minimum wage. Groups that are disproportionately affected by poverty wages. A staggering 48% of black people in Minneapolis live in poverty. Wow. Compared to 13% of white people. Two-thirds of low-wage workers are women, et cetera. So there's a plan to have, have a huge campaign. It's already a huge campaign to make it even bigger. Social Alternative will be sending volunteers to Minneapolis to fight for this and keep reading about this. I don't know where to direct you. Socialalternative.org, obviously. Vote for 15mn.org. Social Alternatives newspaper. We have a whole article. Just looking quickly at this new issue of Social Alternative, the center page is always the long article is on socialism rising, the case for socialism, and we've already gotten into that a little bit. Fight capitalism, join the socialists. This is very important. Socialist students and organizing around college students. Wage theft, political polarization sharpens, stuff about Trump, of course. It's too bad we have to write about Trump, but Seattle REI workers win raises, better hours through struggles, etc. That's the one thing, you get some good news. It's not all just, doom and gloom, although there's plenty of that, and you have to analyze the doom and gloom. Also, Massachusetts schools face big budget cuts, and this is, of course, Democratic Party territory, Massachusetts. And that's why you got to get over the lesser evil thing. Those of you out there that are still buying into it, back page, and here's a good our case for that. Build a new party with 99% support Jill Stein. Now, what does that mean? Basically means that we see Jill Stein's campaign in terms of the issues it's bringing up, in terms of the people it's attracting, as a step towards a workers' party, some sort of party for the 99% in the future. We're not endorsing the Green Party per se. We're not saying the Green Party is a fully formed left party. It's got some interesting features to it. There was just an anti-capitalist clause or something passed recently within the Green Party. And of course, the Stein campaign supports single payer, $50 minimum wage, erasing student debt, free college, public universities. And then, people say, but she's not going to win. And I'm like, well, of course not. She's not going to win. But that's not the point. The point is she gets a decent number of votes that will secure ballot status even further for the Green Party, which is used by a lot of left wingers to run in because of that ballot status. There's definitely a left wing to the Greens that I think will become part of a new workers' party in the future. And also just that, the more the independent politics, like the Green Party, she doesn't get any corporate donations, the more that it does well, the more the possibility for a workers' party becomes at least an idea, and for us, a concrete reality by attracting hopefully some of the people from her campaign into the longer struggle for a workers' party and for socialism. So and it's also a protest vote, if you want to look at it more simply, against the corporate politicians and corporate politics. Now, often when we get these the new issue of the paper, we like to read this section of Why I Am a Socialist. Usually a young person, not always, but usually a young person talking about why they became a socialist. So this month's is Gabe Shelton Jenk. That's Shelton Jenk is the last name, Gabe, a student and restaurant worker in Seattle. He says, quote, I'm not sure I'll read all of it, but try to get the gist of it. For most of my life, I believed in many kinds of the same things as socialists without being one myself. I have known that workers need rights, that the environment needs protection, that college is too expensive, that the wealth gap is wrong, and that oppression in all forms must be fought, whether it's sexism, racism, homophobia, or transphobia. Perhaps my awareness came from growing up queer in a very conservative region with a public school teacher mother. I saw how my mom's job was always under attack from the right, but also how through organized labor they managed to win material victories. Moving to Seattle from a small town made real many issues I had only read about beforehand. I saw how those issues were built into the system we live in. In Seattle, as in many major cities, the gap between the 1% and the 99% is highly visible. I'm going to stop reading there for 1 second. They're going through a huge rent, you know, increase there. Rental properties. A lot of people getting forced out of Seattle now. It's sort of like Boston. There's like the city's somewhat contained. I think it's geographically bigger than Boston, but it's somewhat contained. And now it's just like getting filled up, just gentrified. And even where it's not, even where people, you know, and people are like stacking up 3, 4, 5, 6 to what used to be like a 1 or 2 bedroom just to, you know, live. And it's just getting horrible, the rents. Anyway, back to quoting Gabe Shelton Jack, a new member of Socialist Alternative and a new socialist, I would gather, as well. I go to Seattle Central College, he says, where many students are forced to take out crushing loans to pay for community college. Wow, just to pay for community college. Just a few blocks down from the same street at Seattle University, an expensive private college, a few students are paying full tuition, completely out of pocket. This disparity, I came to realize, was not merely the fault of right-wing politicians, but rather the system of capitalism itself, which is set up to benefit the 1% and the massive corporations and divide the rest of us. At first, I believe the Democrats, just like we were talking about, I believe the Democrats were the best way to fight the world's problems. But through following city politics and the Sanders campaign, I saw how the Democratic Party is too indebted to big business and too dedicated to maintaining their establishment to take the real lead on social change, on real change. In fact, it was at a Bernie rally that I first met a socialist alternative organizer and saw Shama Sawant speak. Before, I felt like socialism was only a vague ideal and that third parties couldn't get anything done. But now the truth is, however, that socialism is a viable alternative to capitalism, excuse me, and millions of people are ready for it. 15 now, the anti-slumlord law, and recently the fight for paid family leave, and I'm going to stop there just with a little note. That's all happening in Seattle, generated by Shama Sawant and Socialist Alternative, Shama Sawant being in power, being recently reelected to city council. So these three things, the $15 minimum wage, which already passed, the anti-slumlord law, which I believe passed, and recently the fight for paid family leave, which I think still is in progress, excuse me, again, have shown me when the people unite, they can win real victories over big business. Socialist Alternative is leading the charge on these issues, overcoming roadblocks set by Democrats. I am a socialist because socialism is a future worth fighting for, and because when we fight, we win. So that was great, and that's no accident having someone from Seattle in the new issue of the paper. We've got 7 branches of Socialist Alternative out there, growing very rapidly through Shama Sawant being the high-profile city councilor, member of Socialist Alternative, not hiding our politics in any way, and about to start a big drive on many campuses to organize students. I'm bound to do a public service announcement here on WMFO every so often, and I'm going to do one now, maybe 2, because I didn't do one last hour. And these are kind of, they can be anything from like practical home stuff to general things about political, sort of political. But anyway, here's one that's sort of in the middle. Numbers to think about prescription drug versus medical marijuana deaths. So this is for people that are really into smoking pot, I guess. I don't know. We'll see. Number of Americans that die each day from an accidental overdose of prescription drugs. Do you have a guess, Diego?
Average people? How many people?
How many? It's each day, so it's not that high, but it's high. It's
in the United States?
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Americans, yep.
10.
Close. 54. The reason I say close is because I would have thought maybe thousands or something, but 54 is bad enough. Number of human beings that have died from an overdose of medical marijuana in all of recorded history? 0.
Really?
That's what they say. Who knows? I find a lot of the pot-induced science a little suspect, but I'll believe it.
You still get some lung cancer. I mean, come on.
You smoke pot. I mean, smoking is still bad for you. It's just not as bad as cigarettes, maybe, but still.
I agree, but I think there's many people out there that wouldn't. But yeah, I mean, like for some people, it's like you start talking about pot. It's like you're triggering the lesser evil gene or nerve, you know. And they start like, what do you mean? There's nothing wrong with pot. Pot's beautiful. Pot's wonderful. I can't get by 5 minutes without pot. You know? Okay, if that's really what you want, then go for that, baby. Anyway. Yeah, I mean, like the tail end of my childhood, my junior and high school years, was the late 70s, and that was saturated with pot, man, just saturated. Where I come from, at least, working class school and everything.
Woodstock? And are you close to Woodstock? When you
were sort of close to Woodstock, but I grew up, you know, close enough to cities that the pot was like flowing, also, and. I never liked it. I never wanted to try it. I never Canada, the whole thing. And I just never, but there was a whole culture that I was exposed to of just, that was like you centered your day around that stuff, man, your evening and everything else and your music. And it just was like, became the ground zero of your life. And I couldn't get into that aspect of it either. But anyway, there's one more political public service announcement. Numbers to think about, PSA, for public service announcement. Some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates 24% of its prisoners and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. Ouch. A public service message from WMFO and Medford Tufts Educational Radio. You know, I saw a map recently on, you know, you get those Facebook memes and diagrams and stuff. And are you on Facebook?
No.
Oh, you should do it. I actually recommend it to a certain extent. it can become addictive. I spend, I'm actually caught way back on it. But
again, simple, you know. Right, Jeff? Simple. Simplicity is the best.
Well, you can do Facebook from any computer, but yeah, I hear what you're saying. But it also has this instant messaging aspect to it that's pretty good. I find I still like doing email better because of the formatting. But you know, you get some interesting stuff on Facebook. Anyway, so what I was gonna say was, I got this map of like U.S. military bases just in the Middle East. They're like everywhere, man. And it's like.
To, America,
well, I've seen them of worldwide. There's in fact, I had a stat in my head that I think I said on the radio a couple weeks ago of how many U.S. military bases there are worldwide, and there's like a lot, like 170 or something. And don't quote the number. Got to fact check that one. But it's just so many. But the map I saw was just in the Middle East alone, you know. And if you had to like say you were from another planet and you landed and say, yeah, why are all these weapons concentrated in that one area? There must be something very valuable there. You know, it comes down to the oil thing once again, you know. Oil.
And ISIS run amok.
Well,
bases everywhere.
Well, that's a whole, exactly. With all the military bases, they're not selling ISIS because the cause of ISIS is deeper than that. But you're right. I just want to, well, actually, we'll play another Green Day thing in a minute. I don't know why. Why doesn't eject work on this? All right, here we go. There we go. Green Day. So, hold on one second, people. Just got to get the right number up. It's actually pretty hot in here. The studio. The ideas. So, I take it you're not going to Cuba this summer.
No. It's already over anyway, so
yeah,
next year, we'll see. Hopefully, you know, and by then I'll get accumulated vacation time.
So that restaurant thing, that's when you were there last time, you saw tons of Western restaurants opening up in Cuba, or just general restaurants from people that were there?
Just people that were
doing
there
the tourist thing.
Run, actually state-run restaurants.
Yeah, getting ready for the tourists.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, everything over there is state-run, you know what I mean? Yeah, as far as that industry, you know, you couldn't just like, Jeff, you have a business idea? Yeah, okay, open up your Polish or something like that restaurant, kibasa restaurant, you know?
I've read that you can do that, you just got to go through the paperwork and everything. And now there's American startups there that have successfully, quote-unquote, maneuvered and gotten the right permission and all that. Not just restaurants, but other things. So it's all, like we talked about earlier, it's all getting invaded. That's a lot of on top of everything else, a lot of false pride that the Castro administration has that they can think they can overcome capitalism. You know, like, we're special. We're not going to let, we're so special that it's not going to matter if people are accumulating capital through exploiting labor here. We're going to have some sort of different dynamic. No, it's going to, that's going to result in political power at some point. It always does. And in fact, can't happen without state power. If you didn't have, they didn't have the Castro regime running, you know, controlling things, people would just like, you know, take over in Cuba just like anywhere else. You know what I mean? Capitalism has to have a strong state to survive.
What's going on in Syria right now?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Or like Libya. Libya's another one. There's five... I don't know if you noticed, but...
There's five sections now. They say five different nations or territories in Libya. Five. One side is by some renegade general. The other side is this ISIS right in the middle. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. It's that was Hillary's doing, by the way. She was when she was Secretary of State, that was her main thing, was to get rid of Gaddafi, and she sure did. You know, they sure got rid of Gaddafi, all right, and brought in and which is, you know, whatever. We have no love for Gaddafi, but, you know, U.S. imperialism doesn't care about democracy or what was post Gaddafi unless they can control it, and they're a little worried now they can't control what's going on. Obviously, speaking of $15 an hour. Up in Montreal, supporters of Socialist Alternative in Quebec, and that's a separate organization called Alternative Socialiste, up in Quebec, but affiliated to the Committee for Works International also, they're doing a $15 an hour minimum wage campaign. And there's an interview at socialistworld.net, that's the website of the Committee for Works International. And there's apparently 280 workers at the Old Port of Montreal have been on strike since May 27th. That's a long time. That's like 3 months, 4 months. They want to make what workers in other parts of the city are making. For some reason, they're making a lot less, and they want to make more. And then $15 an hour will bring them up to some comparative, level. And the Old Port is owned by a Canadian government corporation. That's interesting. Anyway, there's a union involved, PSAC. And it's funny how close, you know, Canada and Montreal are to here. For example, Massachusetts and a lot of the United States, northern border. And you don't hear anything about Canada. And I had a member of Alternative Socialiste on the air here in one of our shows. Anyway, we would ask activists and union members across Canada, but I'd say this could happen down in the U.S. too. Why not? Build the fight for 15 an hour in other areas will greatly help the struggle. Key issue for the working class. Send messages of support to the union involved, PSAC Local 10333. I won't give the whole address. It's in Montreal, PSAC Local 10333. Financial support to Syndicat des Employés de la Société de Vieux-Port de Montréal, which basically means the Union of Workers of the Old Port, Society of Union of Workers of the Old Port in Montreal, at the same address, PSAC Local 10333. And also, there's this new prime minister in here, Trudeau, justin.trudeau@parl.gc.ca, urged the government of Canada to intervene and support the workers of the Old Port. They, Trudeau, I don't know enough about the situation really to say authoritatively, but I think, that's what I was just going to say. Maybe, I think so. And also, I think he's being perceived as a welcome change to Harper, who was very conservative, but Trudeau is basically not much better. It's sort of a lesser evil thing going on up in Canada. Also on the CWI website, socialistworld.net, there was this long strike of bus cleaners in Athens that was led by Saginima, which is the and a union, the Athens Bus Workers Union, OASA. And they there was a long strike, and a strike in the midst of this horrible depression in Greece, brought on by the policy of the European Central Bank and the collapse and the capitulation of Syriza. And yet they're able to win this strike. And that's very, very interesting to me. They got back wages. They got the company, I believe they wanted to privatize it, and I think they stopped that. They stopped some outsourcing. The funny thing is they were actually, it looks like they were striking against someone appointed by Syriza, because the transportation system might be run by the government there. I'm not sure. It looks like it might be. So they, and they had to do this over time with a lot of different struggles, not just one shot. And it was infused with, it became an international campaign launched by the CWI. So it was a lot of radical and socialist ideas infused in it. By the way, I use radical in a positive way most of the time. So just, there's this thing now, I don't know if you've noticed, but they're writing articles about Trump and the Republicans becoming sort of a radical, and this is in quotes, alternative to the Democrats of Hillary, because Hillary and the Democrats are satisfied with the way things are. They are. Like, for example, Hillary's running on Obama's record, partially saying, you know, everything's okay, and they're and Trump will use right wing populism. He doesn't really mean it, but he'll say, "Oh, I want American jobs, and I want to get rid of. I'm against these trade agreements." Whereas, you know, Hillary was formerly for the TPP, and now says she's against it. No one believes her, you know, or anyone with any ounce of sense doesn't believe her. And so, anyway, there's this whole positioning of like somehow Trump and company want to shake things up, and therefore the word radical is attached to them, which I find a joke. Because Trump is extremely mainstream. He's a businessman, corporate, you know, exploiter of other people's labor and all that, and nature. He goes around building golf courses. I mean, he's probably responsible for more environmental destruction than I would care to, like, anyone would care to add up. But anyway, the whole point is, like, to attach radical to something like that, she seems so bizarre to me. Yet I'm reading it more and more in the corporate media, you know, the radical right and radical this, and yeah, attached to conservative stuff.
That's the liberal media, their ammunition towards, you know, the right wing, or quote-unquote.
But what's implicit in that is that, and this is what the writers have been, I think there's an article in The Atlantic about this, Atlantic Monthly. What's implicit in that is that the status quo is okay with the liberals and with the Democrats. And you know what? That's true. And that's something that a lot of people that are holding their nose and voting Democrat don't understand. That not only are they voting corporate, but they're sending a signal that they're satisfied with the status quo. And I know they're not, a lot of people. You know what I mean? They don't see that, they don't see that aspect of it, you know? And more, and you know, most of Clinton's, you know, campaign is against Trump, and it's not for really changing anything. You know, she'll use the populist rhetoric from time to time, but there's no real program. I mean, and you know, she's backing off of a lot of the stuff she was forced to talk about from Sanders, but even that stuff was mild, you know, in comparison to what's needed and some of what Sanders was putting forward, although Sanders didn't go that far with that many issues. But anyway, my point is just that, you know, suddenly because the people that consider themselves, in many cases, some sort of, like they equate liberal with left, which is a big mistake, because liberal is fundamentally pro-capitalist, just into trying to find a nicer face for capitalism. But people that don't understand that, they equate liberal with left, and then they're going to vote for the status quo, pretty much, you know, because there's been 8 years of 8 years of Democratic Party through Obama, another Democratic Party candidate running on Obama's, you know, legacy, which she thinks is good, which most people don't. There was, by the way, there was a good interview in, again, the Louisiana, part of Louisiana that was flooded, and they interviewed this guy, and he was black, and he was, you know, complaining about what a lot of the other people were complaining about, and then on his own, he just brought up Obama, and he said, I thought the way we would solve some of these things is vote Democrat and get Obama in, and, so I started paying attention to politics, you know, and I just realized it doesn't really work for me at all. And he's like back to doesn't know what he's going to do. He goes, I'll take care of myself, I guess, you know. And so like a lot, like millions and millions of other people, they just lost faith in that aspect of it. And they're trying to, like, and that goes back to the book review also. Every presidential election in, you know, since really the two parties cemented themselves, the duopoly really cemented itself, although there have been challenges from time to time, it's mostly been very solid. Republicans or Democrats, back and forth, ping pong, lesser evilism.
You had Eugene Debs at one time, right?
You had Eugene Debs by like, what, 1908, you know, fighting that.
Well, I think it was, probably 08, but also after that. But also, there's a part of the hidden history of the American working class, in a general sense, is that there are often challenges to the two-party system that are pretty significant. And yet, once they're over, the way the corporate media deals with that, including a lot of academics and a lot of liberal activists, is to just basically ignore them and say they never really were much of a challenge, never really did do anything. And, you know, like the Mississippi Freedom Party,
never heard of it.
Yeah, 64, wow. Johnson again. You know, they were shut out violently from the Democratic Party, from getting anywhere within the Democratic Party. They wanted to reform it. Didn't work, of course. Many, many examples. And sometimes individuals, sometimes organized movements. And yet they sort of disappear down the memory hole, you know, and no one remembers them the next time. And the two-party system is presented as natural and everything.
The graveyard.
Yeah, graveyard of social movements, Democratic Party, exactly. So, basically, sort of the history is erased every time you start, and it seems like from some perspectives in the corporate media, you're always starting from scratch when it comes to politics. And, oh, there's nothing out there to the left of Hillary Clinton. Are you kidding me? There's tons. There's tons of space. And what's bad, the way this comes back around to bite people is that they think they're voting for an alternative to Trump. And they're voting for some of the same aspects of Trump. And in order to capture Trump voters and others, the Democrats, never starting out as far left as people think, but relatively speaking, shift to the right. You know, and the right grows. Things that were considered, unimaginable, but in the past are okay, in terms of certain policies and so on. And, like, look how weak the unions are. Down to, if lesser evilism worked, the unions would be a lot stronger. But instead, they're down to 6% in the private sector, and around 30% and falling in the public sector. And so that's, lesser evilism does not work to keep working people's living standards increasing. They're decreasing. It doesn't work to keep unions and other things working people need, institutions the working class needs, growing. Now, a little bit of international news. In Chile, there's a big private pension system that the Chilean dictatorship under Pinochet brought in. But unlike here, where pensions are disappearing, right? Another thing, if lesser evilism worked, we'd all have a pension, most workers would have a pension. And it's flipped since the 80s, it's 70s and 80s. It's flipped now. In the 90s and 2000s, most workers don't have a pension. So in Chile, there's a pension crisis, but instead of just taking it and voting for Democrats, which is always a big mistake, they're having these huge protest marches all around the country. 400,000, over 400,000 in Santiago. This is from an article from August 24th, which is very recent. What's today, by the way?
28th.
Let's look. 28th. Yeah. Okay. So I just look at my phone. I didn't even think of that. I turned it back on. I hope no one calls. August 28th. Yeah. Anyway, so this represents a new pinnacle of mass anger and protest in a country which has been rocked by waves of militant student movement over the last decade. Sunday's protests, with the old and young participating in large numbers. Imagine young people here protesting for pensions. I don't really, unfortunately, haven't seen that in my lifetime. Represents the beginnings.
Have pensions.
Yeah, or Social Security, though, or health care. I mean, youth are often absent in struggles for health care, pensions, and Social Security because we're taught to look so short-term. I mean, capitalism is a short-term system. Short-term maximization of profit is the god. Is your rate of profit going up in the next quarter, or is it going down? That's what matters, most of all. And people are taught to think short-term, look short-term. Despite some of the rhetoric, hey, make sure you're saving some money for your retirement. Why? Because you got rid of my pension and you want to get rid of Social Security and I'm supposed to save money. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I'm supposed to save money for retirement. Screw that. It's impossible. Anyway, getting back to this, it's just the point I wanted to make that they're fighting back in Chile over some of the same stuff happening here. Unions are involved. Members of Socialismo Revolucionario, CWI in Chile, is involved. This was written by Socialismo Revolucionario reporters from Chile. And they're going to do a general strike November 4th, apparently around this demand. Do we get any news from Chile here? I don't think so. do you get any?
Telemundo,
yeah, okay.
But
yeah.
It's very reactionary.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, my son's starting Spanish now in school. And I'm like, there's so much Spanish around. If you don't do good at this, you're in trouble. So he'll be watching reactionary Telemundo, probably, unfortunately. Another article I want to turn people on to, again, this is from the socialistworld.net website, written by a socialist in Russia, a Marxist in Russia named Rob Jones. He writing about 25 years since the coup against Gorbachev, meaning, you know, 25 years since they pretty kind of solidified the capitalist system back in Russia. A really good article. Don't have time to get into it. Maybe save it for next time. But it shows the decline in living standards for the average Russian so viciously. A new period of instability opening up in Russia now. And the idea of capitalism working is an open question for a lot of Russians. Now, here's an article. Dear Democrat Party, let's talk lesser evilism again. Actually, I didn't get a chance to really read this one, so I'm going to also save this one. There's a lot of, as lesser evilism comes up again, there's a lot of talk about Gore throwing the 2000 election. And I was listening to National Propaganda Radio, and this was the exact wording of this sentence. It was, and of course, nobody disputes that Gore threw the 2000 election. This was from that, if I knew her name, you'd probably recognize the name. It was one of their main nightly newscasters. And I've never heard such propaganda in my life. I mean, that's just dead wrong. Plenty of people have studied this and decided that Gore didn't throw the election. You know, that's just incredibly wrong, that there's a million other things going on at the same time, or a bunch of other things going on at the same time that threw the election. So this is Andrew Stewart, Counterpunch, August 26th. Did Gore throw the 2000 election? Just a couple quick points, and hope you can read this. Go read this at counterpunch.org. By the way, I sent an email to the editor, one of the editors at Counterpunch. He sent me a nasty reply. They're very nasty at Counterpunch. You know, I still read them, but yeah, basically he was
Chris's Hedge, right?
No, Chris not Chris Hedges. He's not the most, you know, not the nicest guy in the world either. But no, this is Jeffrey St. Clair. So I wrote in because he did this like throwaway anti-Trotskyist thing. And I realized it might be a joke, but there was no indication it was. So I was just like, you know, I can't believe you're bringing up this old Stalinist propaganda against Trotsky and so on. And he goes, oh, I'm glad that other people on the left have more of a sense of humor than you, or something like that. You know, like, yeah, I'm like, so I just wrote back saying, next you're going to tell me that Coburn, who was the editor who died a few years ago, wasn't trashing Lenin, because he would go and trash Lenin. And they call themselves America's premier left website or something. But anyway, That's neither here nor there. He didn't really write back. So, but they put some good essays on this website, counterpunch.org. And so this guy, Andrew Stewart, writes, the Nader baiting continues untrammeled and was even on display with CNN Green Party Town Hall. Did you hear about that? On CNN, they had the Green Party candidate. Like, Jill Stein's getting a lot more press than she got last time she ran. Have you noticed that at all?
I have basic cable. So I don't get the CNN, but... And again, I do listen to more radio than TV. I just find it more informative than all the stuff you get on TV nowadays.
Yeah, I listen to way too much radio because of my commute, but it is like the same. I don't know. Maybe a little more informative. I mean, the way the corporate media works is that even now even now with the internet and newspapers going downhill, newspaper reporters, to a certain extent, are the bedrock, the foundation of the corporate media propaganda. They are given the money and time to go out and actually research something, and usually the radio and TV stations are pulling stuff from Associated Press or New York Times or Wall Street Journal or something like that. So it's still kind of a I don't know if you call it AP print media, but I guess it's all based on that whole model still to a certain extent. Like, rarely do you find radio stations, TV stations investing in real journalism, quote unquote. Real journalism, meaning digging up some facts, but then making them fit the capitalist paradigm. So it's not, that's not very real in that sense.
Well, I do have an alternative, at least one. That's why I keep paying $30 for my for the cable that I have, just for that one listeners. I'm sorry, viewers supported. I mean, 100%. This is not PBS. This is viewers supported. If they don't get the money from the viewers, obviously, so they're not. It's called Link TV. Yeah. And they're obviously not, corporatized. You know what I mean? So you do have way better, you know, alternative media there because it's viewer supported. That's the only way you're going to do it. You just get that money, you know, separate corporate from, you know, having your station ran as opposed, you know, for the viewers. That's more democratic.
Yeah, I agree totally. There are some good alternative TV, a few you can get on the internet, alternative TV, quote unquote, alternative radio. Nothing like this show, though. I don't find anything that's openly socialist, but I hope one of these days that changes. Hope we have our own TV station one of these days, socialist alternative television. But anyway, getting back to this debunking of the Al Gore 2000 election myth that it was Nader's fault that Gore lost. Not that I care, by the way, that Gore lost.
How was it Nader's fault?
Exactly. Well,
it was either Bush or Gore.
Right. Right. Well, it was very close, and they claimed that because it was so close, the votes Nader got drew away from Gore. Now, this is a big supposition, right? That, oh, I won't vote for Nader. If I didn't vote for Nader, I'd vote for Gore. Now, I voted for Nader in that election, and you could put a gun to my head, and I would never vote corporate, never vote for the Democrats or the Republicans. So I'm sure there's somebody in Florida with the same, I will call, gutsy outlook that I had. You know what I mean? Like they can do whatever they want to me, and I'm never going to vote Democrat or Republican because that's my class enemy, and I understand that. You know, that's the corporate political structure. And I feel sorry for people that call themselves socialists and workers that don't understand that. I'm willing to discuss it and so on. But that's not the way I roll, and I never have. I've never voted for them. Even when I was a kid, I realized something was wrong. Those are not the people I grew up with. Those are not in the suits. I would never vote for a Republican, never. No. Or a Democrat.
How old were you when Nixon was in
the Couldn't vote. Couldn't vote. Couldn't. Yeah. I couldn't vote till the election in, I believe, 80. Was that an election year? 80?
Yeah, 79.
Yeah, so I voted for John Anderson. I voted for John Anderson, who was came on as a progressive, really in retrospect more of a moderate, but he was independent of the two parties. So I voted for him. And never in local, national, or state elections have I ever voted Democrat or Republican or Libertarian, by the way. I would never do that. I always vote for a left winger, if I can find one, independent, or maybe a left wing green or something. And if I can't find anyone to the left, then I'll write somebody in. I'll write in Leon Trotsky. I'll write in George, who was the Black Panther comrade that was murdered.
Fred Hampton.
When I say George, I'm always talking about Fred Hampton now, so I spaced on his name. Thank you. I write in Fred Hampton, etc. Anyway, so this guy, Andrew Stewart, I'm going to have to speed read here. We're running out of time. But he's like, the basic fact is this. Al Gore threw the fight with George Bush over Florida's bizarre electoral process. It had nothing to do with Nader and everything to do with the transformation of the presidency by Clinton, our first post-Cold War president. Clinton's reckless economic policies and utopian visions of neoliberal paradise made Gore behave like the Black Sox. He's using a historical reference to baseball. I don't know why. Anyway, for confirmation of these points, I would advise readers to consult economist Robert Pollan's very useful book, Contours of Dissent, U.S. Economic Fractures, and the Landscape of Global Austerity, an analysis of the Clinton economy. And that's very interesting. I'd love to read this book, and I urge others to read it. Pollan, I believe, is an economist out at Perry, Public Something Research Institute, Public E, what's the E stand for? Anyway, it's out at UMass Amherst. Contours of Dissent, U.S. Economic Fracture, Landscape of Global Austerity. So he's basically talking about how unpopular Gore was. And then, more on Clinton. This is a very good article. I just don't have time to get into it. So what I'm looking for, though, is this is refreshing because he's not, a lot of people will attack the Nader myth based on just the machinations of the electoral system down in Florida, like the hanging chads and all that. Remember that? Like they didn't count them right and all that. He's getting more into why people didn't like Gore, which is very good. So anyway, maybe we'll save this one also for the future because it's worth going into in detail, where he really goes after in detail Clinton. So the basic thesis here is, this is Bill Clinton. He's going into that. I don't think the basic thesis here is that Gore was on the ropes because of the the economic policies of the Clinton administration that really hurt the working class. But you know, some of the more superficial arguments are Gore basically caved because he didn't want the election to go any longer. I don't know if you remember that time. I don't know how old you were, but at that time, the bourgeois, you could tell, was very worried. They hadn't settled the presidential election thing. So Gore was under a lot of pressure to settle, even if the results were under question. People have analyzed the voting patterns and said Gore actually won, but they didn't fight for Gore to win. Gore himself didn't fight to win, which proves that the ruling class has a general plan for the rule, not just based on one individual here or there, which is very true.
Well, is that Michael Moore movie where they all these representatives got up, even him, Gore, I mean, they were getting up to fight for him to, like, come on, you know, grow some cojones, you know? And he himself was going, sit down, no, veto, whatever it was. And I'm like, yeah, this guy's obviously, you know.
I agree totally, and I wouldn't even necessarily make it an individual thing, but it's partially there, like you're saying, Diego, that Gore himself probably got the news. It's you have to take one for the team being the capitalists, and we had to settle this thing, you know. But even if that didn't happen, right? It was there was obviously Gore didn't feel confident enough to have a full count. There's a premise we talked about earlier that, oh, if someone doesn't vote for Gore for Nader, they're going to vote for Gore. That's crap. And there is as weak as they're made to seem, there are left challenges to the Democrats on a regular basis in U.S. politics. The current Jill Stein campaign is one of them, and we urge a vote for Jill Stein and promotion of Jill Stein's campaign here at Socialist Alternative Radio and with Socialist Alternative as a whole. Also, stuff about the cheating on the ballots based on what was happening down there, but also the bourgeois, we were just talking about lining up behind Bush, telling Nader to cool it down and all that. And there's other like kind of arguments based on things wrong with how votes were counted in Florida, how votes are counted nationally, the Electoral College and all that. There's all these elaborate arguments proving that on a superficial level, no, Nader did not cost Gore the election. On the other hand, and then there's like all these premises in the idea that he did that don't stand up. What they really don't like is the fact that Nader, for all his faults, and he's got many, the 2000 election, Nader made an impact. He was filling stadiums the way Sanders was. I'm not sure which had bigger rallies ultimately, probably Sanders, but I'm not sure. Obama was doing the same thing when Obama first ran. When he had a lot of populist rhetoric, people will respond to that stuff. They really do want to make some gains through who they vote for, you know. Unfortunately, they're sold out time and time again because there's no it's individuals rather than a party. Even Nader didn't move to make a workers' party out of his campaigns, and that was a big mistake. So we got to wrap it up here. I don't have any profound last words except we're entering the last few months, obviously, of the election. Again, we encourage you to ditch all the liberal guilt and vote for fundamental change or the step towards fundamental change. Vote for Jill Stein. If you want to have that debate, we welcome it. We take on lesser evilism in all its evil forms. You know, Paul Wolfowitz just came out and endorsed Hillary Clinton. He was the architect of the propaganda for the Iraq War. So you want to vote for Hillary Clinton thinking you're doing something? You're fooling yourself. You're voting for the other side of the coin. Donald Trump on one side, Hillary Clinton on the other. Yeah, anyway, so think about that, and we'll be back in a couple weeks. Diego, you get the last word.
Yeah, power to the people, like always, and keep your head up. Continue to struggle.
And we're going to go out with that song we were going to play earlier, Holiday by Green Day. Maybe we'll put on Imagine by John Lennon, sort of one of our theme songs. Thank you for listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. You are listening to WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. Socialist Alternative Radio is every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio. Thank you for listening. And keep, like Diego said, keep up the fight for liberation of the working class internationally.